now, right? Okay. The next presentation, A Personal History of Paramount Records, will be presented by a legendary figure, actually, a gentleman named Mr. John Steiner, who simply asked me to introduce him as a record collector and sometime owner of Paramount Records. So that's how I'm going to do that. Mr. John Steiner with his assistant, Michael Hatfield.
I'm going to ask him to run through a few of the slides that he's brought and mention something that he's uncovered, recording as a result, I guess I should have been on the stuff. Some of the material that he's gathered relating to the recording activity of Wisconsin Shear Company, that Paramount, I've got to talk about, is just a little department in a big corporation. Mike has discovered a lot of information about the origins of that corporation, and he'll tell you about that before I talk.
Thank you, John. Well, once again, my name is Mike Hatfield, and I'm really a novice at this. I'm a Milwaukee public school teacher teaching French, Spanish, and English, and I happen to be a guitar player. I prefer Jimi Hendrix to some of the earlier kinds of music mentioned already. But my love of blues music led me to read a lot about old blues genre, and I kept coming across the name Paramount Records of Port Washington, Wisconsin, and hearing about the Wisconsin Share Company, and finally I thought, yeah, I gotta look into this. So I did, and ran across John's name and address in the Ozaukee County Historical Society in a letter that he had written to a gentleman who lived on the property on which Paramount Records were made. So I contacted him, and ever since then, he's been teaching me an awful lot about it. So we'll run through. This first one shows the street sign on the way up to two important towns in our story. Paramount Records, headquartered in Port Washington, and the pressing plant in Grafton. This is an old print from 1888 of Port Washington, aerial view, showing the port and harbor, which was important to the Chair Company. They wanted to, of course, be able to ship their product and have wood brought in from their lands in Kentucky and northern Wisconsin. So the port was important. This man, Bostwick, was a big man in Port Washington, wealthy. He was a jeweler, said to carry around diamonds in his pocket, and he purchased a little place by the harbor called the Sash and Door Company, and when it went up for sale, and this he turned over to Fred Dennett, who is seated on the right here, along with his brother John Dennett on the left. And Fred Dennett was a Sheboygan native who in the 1880s was involved with a guy named Mattoon, George Mattoon, up there. And their venture went badly. And so Mattoon stayed up in Sheboygan, but Dennett said, I'm going to go take advantage of that port down in Port Washington. And he created the Wisconsin Share Company down there from that little sash and door company. So now we have an older advertisement here showing the wonderful Wisconsin Chair Company of Port Washington. It goes on and on listing all the accolades. And this is a photograph showing the Chair Company in its heyday. Nowadays, of course, it's all gone and they've reworked the harbor somewhat. This is just an old fire insurance map showing the Wisconsin Chair Company by the harbor. Very quickly, this operation took off, and they made chairs and furniture for the masses, relatively inexpensive stuff, but pretty good quality. They were incorporated in 88. Work began for 35 men in September of 88, and a Wisconsin Chair Company acquired the patent for the McLean swing rocking chair in 91, and then they began to really take off, and up until about 99, they did a great business. This one shows their little barge, which they bought, and you can see behind it the stacks and stacks of lumber that were out warping on their own, as it were, for their veneering, all right? And this is a 1892 cover of one of their catalogs, and it shows already the McLean's patent swing rocker. They were well known for this. And a couple of things from there, their chair and a table. And then in 1899, the Wisconsin Chair Company burnt down pretty much to the ground and taking with it many of the buildings of downtown. You can show the next slide, it'll show the fire damage. This is where Smith Brothers would be, over to the right nowadays, and you can see the harbor there. But the devastation was pretty much complete, and Fred Dennett wanted to take and move the company back up to Sheboygan. He was pretty saddened by this. Bostwick convinced him with a little bit of padding in the wallet to stay in port, and it was important for him because at this point, the Wisconsin Chair Company was the largest employer in Ozaukee County at that time. It was very important economically. And this is from a 1911 postcard showing the renewed, it says, the factory district in winter, Fort Washington. So the Wisconsin Chair Company buildings are the white ones over on the right. And this is a photograph showing the rebuilt chair company. Up on the hill farther away from the harbor is a building which still exists. It was called Chair Factory Number 2. It was owned by the Wisconsin Chair Company, and it was here that they stored many of the phonograph cabinets that were made, and then later on phonograph records, which came from Grafton, Wisconsin, after that building was torn down. This is a modern day picture I took a few years back. The building's still there. It's part of Simplicity Manufacturing now. And this building is near the harbor in Port Washington. It's another one of the original structures associated with the Wisconsin Chair Company. The local people call it the Chair Factory Apartments, and they're still apartment buildings. They would have been used by itinerant workers, or perhaps by seamen coming in, bringing in wood and staying overnight, and then leaving again. And then our story really hasn't much to do with chairs and furniture, but rather with the recording offshoot. It was a subsidiary of the Wisconsin Chair Company. They decided to get into the making of wooden cabinets for Edison and other people, the wind-up cabinets, of course, and they started their own line of records as a way to sell more of their phonograph cabinets. They said, well, we'll give away 10 free records if you buy ours. That got to be expensive, so then they ended up making records of their own out of another subsidiary plant at Grafton, Wisconsin, about 6 miles away. This is a picture probably from the 60s showing the office building where Paramount Records was. It was, of course, in the Wisconsin Chair Building complex, and it was on the second floor. John Steiner would have walked up those stairs a few times to speak with Otto Moser during their transactions in the 60s, or actually in the 40s, when John decided to buy it, and I'll let him speak about that later. Here's a Paramount record in its sleeve, familiar to many, I'm sure, and a Puritan record. Later on, they acquired Broadway, and then their famous records. And of course, they made their phonographs large and small. Here's a little one for $26. You could add maybe a couple of zeros to that now. All right. Here's a photograph of the record plant in Grafton, Wisconsin. Again, it's about 6 miles away from Port Washington. It was located by the Milwaukee River. You can see they used the power to run the machinery, which turned the gears, and also to cool the wax when they made their records. The mill race has since moved down the river a little bit because of erosion, and you can see a small hole in the foundation, I'll point out here. And that small hole has grown and grown and grown, as you'll see in the next picture. There's a modern picture of it. The mill race has moved on down. The whole structure is kind of threatened right now by the DNR. They claim it's a hazard to navigation, so it's going to be torn down. This is the chair factory from a different angle, showing the employees. And the first record made in Grafton. And you see the date, 1917. This is one of John's possessions. and one of the metal masters made in Grafton. And this looks like a simple enough Puritan record, but if you look closely, you see it was not made by the New York Recording Laboratories of Port Washington, Wisconsin, but rather by the United Phonograph Corporation of Sheboygan. This confused the heck out of us, John and I, while we were trying to figure out what about this Sheboygan thing. And I dug into it and found out through courthouse records and so forth that the same men owned it. Fred Dent had owned Lakeside Craft Company, which he started up in 1910. Later on in 1916, they decided to get into the phonograph cabinet making business, and then later on they put out their own records. First Puritans, and then later on Paramounts, but we've seen Paramount records from the Mills Library here that are listed UPC as well from Sheboygan. Lakeside Craft Shop ad from a local paper. And this one is a short blurb, rather, saying, this company, second paragraph, this company was started in October 22 by Gordon so-and-so in the building formerly occupied by the United Phonograph Corporation. So they were pretty short-lived. It became Lakeside Craft Company again after UPC pulled out. And here's an ad from 1920, City Directory up in Sheboygan, showing their Puritan phonograph line. Luxury in music, they said. This is a 1950s photograph of the Lakeside Craft Shop building, otherwise known as UPC, and then a modern day picture, which I took. The building's still there. So I think I found every trace that remains, physical trace of the companies owned by Dennett and Boswick. Of course, what really is of interest are not all the different kinds of music put out by Paramount, Puritan, Broadway, and Famous Records, all kinds of classical music and hillbilly and Southern music, as well as, of course, the Race series, the 12,000 into the 13,000 series, is why we remember the Paramount Company today, the jazz and blues musicians from the South who came up and recorded for them. And here are a few examples. In 1927, Paramount Company put out their songbook, which has also had short biographies of some of the major musicians, the Paramount Book of the Blues, notably whitewashed, shall I say. And some of their major stars were highlighted, and several of their songs were in there. The songs haven't been copyrighted by the Chicago Publishing Company, another subsidiary. And a Paramount ad from the Chicago Defender, black newspaper. This is a close-up of the photo we saw earlier because it shows the office, which became important later on in 1929 when times were tough for everyone. The Paramount Company had been using studios in Chicago. Originally, they were using studios from New York City and basically taking masters from anywhere they could lease them to put out their early material. And then to save money, they came closer and closer to home. They went to Chicago studios, Marsh Laboratories, and others. And then eventually they said, this is getting too expensive, we're going to build our own studio, and they did so in Grafton. So from 1929 till their demise in 32, 33, this office space up on the second floor was converted to a recording studio. No one knows for sure, but there are legends saying that black musicians who weren't especially perhaps welcome in Ozaukee County at that time were brought up in the what they called the Kidney Buster, or the Inner Urban Railway. Others say they came up by car, but some people say they stayed in the local hotel. No one's really sure, but here is a photograph of the Kidney Buster in Grafton. And this is a photo taken from the turn of the century. We're back in Port Washington now, headed towards the lake. What interests us is the building on the far left over here, the one with the bay window up on the second floor. It's now a Yamaha dealership up in Port Washington, but back in those days, 1930s, actually late 20s, a man named Fred Berner, who had worked for the Wisconsin Chair Company in the plating department, was seduced by Maurice Supper to come out of there and sell records by mail order. It was really the first mail order business that succeeded. And this was Berner's shop. And again, John Steiner had been up those stairs as well to deal with Berner. Here's a modern day picture of it. The cars have changed somewhat. And he ran a real aggressive mail order business in which he sold Paramount records and other records. You see Bessie Smith thrown in there on the left, next to Blind Lemon Jefferson, and she was on Columbia, but Berner sold race records to the blacks in the South and ran a pretty aggressive mail order business. Okay, this just shows one of his COD labels. And this is an ad from one of his catalogs. Another one. We can laugh now. They were actually pretty well done ads, most of them, some of them in questionable taste. He also sold other sundries to the supposedly ignorant black customers, among them some pomade products to straighten stubborn kinky hair. Can't have that. And wishing oil and so forth, good luck charms, dream books, interpret your dreams. He got, local legend says that he got in a little bit of trouble for that because the bleaching cream that he sold for skin didn't really work. All right, that showed that the Grafton plant was torn down in 38. Okay, and we have an aerial view of Port Washington showing the later buildings. Okay, so eventually the record company went out of business, and then the chair company did less and less of their own furniture business. During this time, towards the end, when the company went out of business in 54, they were leasing their material to many other smaller companies to put out and reissue Paramount material. Among those people was John Steiner, who was putting it out on the SD label. And eventually, John began negotiations with them and in 1949 purchased the musical interests of the Wisconsin Chair Company from them. Later on in the 50s and 60s, they started to tear the buildings down one by one, making room for the parking lots, the lovely parking lots you saw earlier in the slide. And there's somebody we all know, holding a lovely UPC Puritan. And then you see this is the familiar label, however, this is the 14,000 series, which never existed under Wisconsin Chair Company rule. This was John's domain, and I'll let him talk about that. I bought a King Oliver record from my father from a dealer in Milwaukee for $25 when I first got interested in this, and I thought, boy, I've really got a prize here. This is in perfect condition. And I told John about it, and I said, it's got Baby Dodds and Louis Armstrong on it, too. And he says, how do you know this? I said, it says so right on the label. And he laughed. And he laughed and said, well, how much did you pay for it? I told him, and he said, oh, well. So you live and learn. And the red vinyl were John's later issues. These were the LPs, 33 LPs. From his Chicago Jazz series. And he would advertise on the back of them some of his other issues. And in the 1970s, John sold his interest in Paramount to a man named George Buck. And again, I'll let John explain that. That's his story. But the legacy goes on. This music of these Paramount recording artists, you can flip through these, are going on today. CDs are being put out, the interest is still there for the music, and I'm living proof, I guess, that the interest, and you are too, that the interest in this company is still existent too. Black Swan, yeah, okay. I don't know who these guys are. There's the Port Washington Lighthouse. I'll leave you with that and turn you over to John Steiner, who was a research chemist by trade and a teacher, and is a collector and aficionado of jazz and blues music, and began appreciating and collecting jazz music in 36. So thank you for your attention. I'll turn you over to John.
Your program says something about a personal assignment to this talk, and I thought I needed some background. I couldn't start right off and say in 1941 I bought the Paramount Company. What I did was buy the musical interests of the Wisconsin Chair Company. Like all of the phonograph companies, the Paramount label or the Wisconsin Chair Company was really some other enterprise that thought that phonograph records fit in their category. I think that nearly all of them, well, let's start with Edison. Certainly Edison didn't think that phonograph records was going to be his primary reward for working with a phonograph, but it did turn out to be a significant part of the business just later on. The Wisconsin Chair Company, as Mike pointed out, was largely a furniture business. Finally went into the kind of furniture that made phonograph cabinets, and phonograph cabinets could be sold through their distributors and retailers, but it could only be sold if there were records to go with them. And so they brought in records. I am told that the first records were those for foreign, for immigrants who might like Scandinavian music. And so some Scandinavian records were imported. Sure enough, they helped us sell the phonographs. And other niches such as that is immigrant, were experimented with. And it's turned out that the black audience coming up in Chicago, growing very rapidly in Chicago, was the best market that they could find for early records. This is 1921. They were selling records from other black labels. They purchased the masters or purchased the rights to use masters or purchased records made from these masters and sold by the thousands. So they thought that this was going to be a good business, and for 10 years it was great. Now, those records you saw in 1917 were the outgrowth of the Scandinavian records. Scandinavian records were successful, so they began to just press records that might be called standard repertory. And those went on the Puritan label to start with. That test pressing you saw turned up, as far as we could discover, on a Paramount. Both the front and the back of that test record turned up later on a front and back of a Puritan record. It wasn't by any means the first Puritan record been issued. Perhaps those Scandinavian records, if they did not have Scandinavian labels, had Puritan labels. We haven't found any yet. The record business continued until the Depression years. The Depression brought significant sales losses to certain materials. Booze, for example, lost a big market, and so did phonograph records. Well, there were several other factors. One was radio. Radio meant that people would spend much more time listening to another loudspeaker than they would to their phonograph. But by 1931, there was nothing left for the Wisconsin Chair Company in the phonograph record pressing business except making records for radio distribution, that is, radio transcriptions. They made the first 12-inch radio transcriptions, and maybe you've come upon some of those. They don't tell where they were made or who made them, but they're laundry products, and the laundry product is sold by the record label, or they are refrigerators, and they're sold by the record label. And those 12-inch records distributed only to record, to phonograph, no, distributed only to radio stations are probably more rare than anything else on the market. When you find them, you better turn them over to somebody else who's interested if you're not yourself. They are rare. The reason I'm talking about Paramount is that it was a Wisconsin product, Wisconsin Steer Company. The Wisconsin product, including those other several labels you saw, were not widely distributed. They were distributed where the market was found. The Paramount label, which turned out to be, let's say, historically significant for its musical origins, sold best in Chicago, as I said, and then through the Chicago newspaper into the South, where a lot of mail orders came in. When the mail orders began to come in, when the second and third and fourth ad was put in the Chicago papers, then they saw that there was a separate business, and that's what Borner went into. He said, this is another business. This isn't the Wisconsin Chair Company. This is something I'll develop by myself, and I always employed four or five people packing records and mailing them out at about 6 cents a record. It costs a little more today. But in those days, it was considered educational material. And it was, do you, any of you remember mailing under educational, writing educational material on a record when you mailed it? Because it was 11 cents in the next step up. Educational material, and then suddenly it jumped into 30 cents, and now what is it, a dollar? So records were not hard to ship with a couple pieces of cardboard. The post office was reasonably careful. And if you broke a record, all you had to do was ship back a portion of it, and you'd get a free one. You'd get another one. The record business went into a tremendous slump during the Depression. But after the slump, the development of such things as this Prickly Arm brought back a great interest in high fidelity sound. Hi-fi became a fad. It was a fad like phonographs had been before it. And the phonograph aspects that I was interested in was principally the jazz record by performers whom I came to know when I moved to Chicago. Fortunately, at about the same time, I met an engineer not unlike Pickering, a man who, in fact, had been in close correspondence with Pickering, and I now have several of those Pickering arms that were discussed. His name was Hugh Davis. Hugh Davis died very early of tobacco cancer, and yet he lived long enough to encourage me to get into the record business by saying, yes, we can do it. Hugh Davis had another facility that helped a great deal. He worked for the Seberg jukebox people. You remember the name Seberg in connection with Chicago's jukeboxes? Mills, and what's the third one? There were three. What was it?
Rockola.
Rockola. Those were the three big Chicago firms. Both Mills and Seberg had been in business since the early player piano business of the 90s, 1890. In connection with the jukeboxes, they were interested in this arm that we heard about, but it didn't happen to suit the mechanics of moved over records, the mechanical aspect of the jukebox. So we had the arms in formative years, I think before they were put on the market generally, and they worked exactly as these did. But they look a little rawer than these do. they don't have a finish on them and so forth. When we wanted to go into the record business, it was a period that shellac was not being brought in from the tropics. There was a few years of shellac in the warehouses. People like Victor were entitled to a little shellac, so they didn't go out of business. 10% of the shellac you used to have or something of that sort. Columbia got a little shellac. And of course it was the shortage of shellac that hastened the development of a plastic record later on. But in the shellac years, Seaberg, which had been in the jukebox business, had experimented a little bit with an aspect of business, something like Muzak. They had put out records. And so they had 10% shellac coming. Well, Hugh got that 10% for us. The 10% put us in business. We had 10% of the shellac that the mills used, or that Seaberg used to use, and we had Hugh's expertise in the engineering aspects, and they had my enthusiasm for jazz. So we began to put out a few jazz records that we recorded ourselves. And I learned about Paramount in a much later time. Maybe it was after I got to Chicago. I learned that there was a very rare record called Paramount. It had been pressed up in Milwaukee, and the only place you could find it was out in the black neighborhoods. I went out to black neighborhoods and I found a few of them. And I went up to Port Washington to ask at the chair company what were they doing with the old record business. And they were leasing it out. They showed me that they had leases with Columbia. They had leases with two or three independent firms. I've forgotten what they were. And they'd be glad to lease to me. Well, the lease covered both the right to use whatever was on the record, plus the copyright of whatever was on the record, when they happened to have it copyrighted. Well, for hundreds of records, they did have copyright. They began to get copyrights in 1922. They didn't have earlier copyrights, but they had a lot of copyrights for the blues. So I got the blues and the rights to the records and began to put them out. But some others, in some cases bootleggers, who didn't bother with leases or anything of the sort, some others had began putting out the same material I did. I don't know whether they copied my King Oliver reissues or whether they just happened to program their reissues at the same time I programmed mine. But I went back to Port Washington and complained. Others were using the same material that was being leased to me. And Moser's name was mentioned. More significantly, a man by the name of Cady went into the secret of it all. He said, do you know what our legal bills would be to try to protect you? And he pointed out that most of these bootleggers were on the verge of bankruptcy. They were as bad off as I was, putting out one record a month. If they were able to run a good record business, they'd be putting out 10 a month. So the best he could do was say, if we give you the charge of collecting our royalties and we'll send letters threatening legal action, but we can't afford to take it, will you see what you can do? And I was glad to do that. So for a little while, I was the agent in obtaining leases for Paramount. I discovered that that was a pretty good business. You didn't do anything except a little correspondence, and sometimes you got $50 a year. So I got paid much better. Reissuing Paramounts didn't pay 25 cents an hour. It was just a hobby business. Well, Hugh Davis left me, because he couldn't make money that way, but he could make money running a recording business where he was recording for other people, but because he was a member of a recording company, there was a little conflict there. Both the unions said there was conflict, and the other recording companies said there was conflict. Hugh left me and made more money on the private business, but he still did my business on a commission and on a per job basis. In the first years, I used the Paramount label. Since I had all musical interests, I could use the label, of course. And I used the Port Washington mailbox, which meant I had to go run up there every 2 weeks and pick up the mail and mail out of Port Washington. But that wasn't too hard. They had been bluffing a long time, calling themselves the New York Recording Laboratories, and their only connection with New York was that they bought some records that had been mastered in New York from the Plaza Group. You've probably read some of those stories about how Plaza leased out records to the Mills Group, and they leased out records to Banner and Triangle and Broadway and who else. They also leased out records to Paramount. In the early years, I had recorded Red Nichols and put that out on SD records. And here, Red Nichols was on the original Paramount. It was a kind of reversal of expectation. Red Nichols issued first on our 1940, 78 RPM record. And then Red Nichols issued later as reissues of 1920 records on LP 1950. Then there were lots of the old musicians around from the 20s that I used again for new recordings on Paramount, besides putting out Paramounts of young fellows that I thought were very good in Chicago who hadn't yet been recorded. And maneuvering more ambitiously than I had finances to really develop to get the rights to Edison also. Well, our interest here is only in Paramount, the Wisconsin company. And as we tell you, it was a chair company. It developed from the woods in Wisconsin where the lumber was available. And so it's rather incidental to the record business that Wisconsin got into it. And it's no wonder that the records are quite rare when we know that they were directed toward particular audiences where record companies had not already covered the market. I think there's very little more I can tell you about my connection with it, except that ABC Paramount decided to put out records, and I was able to sell the word Paramount used on a record label for more than I'd paid for Paramount interests. And then I leased first to George Buck, and then I leased to other people. And then George Buck decided that he could buy the company and he could run the leases and so forth. And George Buck, in the same sense that I operated beyond my financial means. George was operating beyond his financial means. It took him a year to pay me off, but George Buck finally bought the record company for much more than I paid for it. So I, as the 25 cents an hour that I told you developed from reissuing records, I made more than that by subsequent maneuvers.
In the interest of time, I've lost my mic. In the interest of time, I'll take about maybe two questions, and that's really about it, okay? Short ones.
Yes.
How many metal parts do they still have up there?
15 or 20. The metal parts were taken by Jack Capp when he was forming Decca Records and leased by Jack Capp. Take a
In the interest of time, I've lost my mic. In the interest of time, I'll take about maybe two questions, and that's really about it, okay? Short ones.
Yes.
How many metal parts do they still have up there?
15 or 20. The metal parts were taken by Jack Capp when he was forming Decca Records, and leased by Jack Capp, taken down to Jeanette. And I got them back from Jeanette. When I said 15, I'd better say 25. I guess it's 25.
So you were able to get the other ones?
Yes, yes. All the other metal had been sold for the nickel and copper in the plate, which I think is about $7. And they sold all that metal after several years of trying to sell it in this country and also in England.
So how many metal parts, counting the ones
who got 25.
Oh, 25. Including
yeah.
the ones from Cap?
Huh?
Including the ones that...
Yeah, yeah, that's about how many Cap had.
Most of your reused off the
Yeah, they're just a handful of metal. And of the metal, only one of a specific interest to me, with the jazz interest I had, one is a piano solo that was issued. But that one metal part is dear to me.
One more question back there?
Do you hear?
The Paramount movie studio, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, Paramount movie studio and the record company, are they attached in any way?
In no way, until ABC Paramount took it over and took over the name. In no way. And this is what allowed me, I had to sue them. Copyrights are for specific groups of things, for books or for shirts or for butter. And ABC Paramount did have copyrights for networks and movie companies, but not for records. And so when I told them that they put me out of business, there I had to bluff a little too. I was putting out 10-inch records, and the 12-inch records was drowning me. And so I knew I had to go out of business. And by this time I was leasing 12-inch records, but I couldn't afford to put them out myself. My distribution was so bad. I had to work at another job to pay the bills. I was just a poor businessman. Not quite daring enough. Interested in the hobby, but not quite daring enough to set up a record company.
Well, John, thanks for coming. You have anything you want to say?
All right.
One more.
Yes. I didn't know that.
Thank you, John. On that note, let's give John another hand. He'll be around.
Thank you.
He's going to be around, John. Yeah. He'll be around. He has questions. Lunch break.